have a handout to help. So you can pass it around.
So you just want me to hold it like this? Is that okay?
Yeah.
It's going to be really odd. Okay, well, I'm speaking today on Vernon Lee. I did undergraduate research on her for about 3 years. And as she said, I went to Cambridge University to actually work with a supervisor to finish up my undergraduate research of her. Nobody's ever really heard of her, so if you haven't, that's fine. She was a British author. She was born in 1856 in France. So
how do I do this?
Okay. She was born in 1856 in France, even though her parents were British. She spent the whole of her life traveling around Europe. They never actually lived in England, but she always said that they never lived the life of a gypsy and said they were residents. They were not tourists. They lived there. They lived in Switzerland, Germany, France, Italy. She actually went back to Italy and spent the rest of her life living in Florence with her mother. She never married, and there's much talk that she was a lesbian. I don't particularly agree with that, but that's a minor part of my research. Anyway, she died in 1935. She was never a part of any major literary circles. She was rather opinionated and offensive, and in fact, one of her major novels, Miss Brown, was basically a critique of all the major literati in London at the day and completely ousted her from the literary circles, so she did have a small following. She was really good friends with Henry James, and you'll notice that because a lot of Henry James' works were mainly psychological, as were Vernon Lee's. With her major works and her significant contributions, she focused mainly on the study of aesthetics, genius loci, and the supernatural. She was very, very influential in terms of aesthetics. In fact, she was one of the first people to ever introduce the term empathy into the English language. It's kind of an odd, an odd idea that she first incorporated, she worked closely with a companion by the name of Kit Anstruther Thompson. A lot of people say this was her lover. I don't believe that at all. Just a close companion, a close friend of hers. And together they conducted very in-depth research on aesthetics and on the idea of empathy, or Einfühlung, which is to identify or to completely place oneself inside of something else. So what would happen is she would take Kit to, let's say, an art museum, and then Kit would go and stand in front of a chair. And she would kind of position her body. She would move around a little bit. She would not try to become the chair, but try to feel as if she was inside of its movement, its lines, its form. And that's the way that she worked with all of her paintings and the artists and the artistry that she studied. She had no specific base. She would work with sculpture, painting, furniture, anything like that. So her and Kit would go around, they would do this research. And eventually it got to be so intense that it kind of took a lot out of Kit, and she dropped out of the research project, and Vernon Lee finished it on her own. Vernon Lee was exceptionally well-read. She was very, very intelligent. She read anything on psychology, geology, geography, physical science, biology, literary theory, aesthetics, anything she could get her hands on. In fact, her library is now in Florence, and if you go there, you can see the extensive markings that are in all of her margins. However, something that's important to remember with Vernon Lee is that even though she was so widely read, she still maintained a focus in art, aesthetics, and especially 17th century Italian music. I didn't do my my thesis on that. Mine focused on the psychological nature of all of her supernatural stories. Another important facet of her work was her research on the genius loci, which is an old Roman term, and it means the spirit of the place. All of us have heard of a man has his genius and a woman has her Juno, which is essentially your muse, your inspiration. And so for Vernon Lee, when one goes to a place, Italy was this place for her. It was kind of a repository of emotion, of feeling, of memories. Your spirit identified inherently with the spirit of this place. And that became a connection that you would feel with that person. And for her, it was a very personal level. In fact, many of her essays and her aesthetic treatises were on the spirit of places. And she would go through travel essays by travel essay through the south of France. She would go on lots of biking tours around the south of France and through Italy and talk about how connected she felt to each of these places and how important they were in her psyche. In her stories, specifically the ones that I looked at, in each of these places, it is the place and this genius loci and art that acts as a psychological catalyst to bring about an obsession with the past. It kind of brings the past into the present day. Okay, really quickly, talking about the significance of her work, there's been a decent break in scholarship about her. This is a brand new edition of Hauntings, where I took most of the stories for my research. It was just published last year. Before that, the last edition was, I think, in 1871, which is when this was. So in order to even purchase her books, I think this one cost me $80, and so that's why I only have one of them. They were not available after 1935 because she had offended so many people and because she wasn't part of the specific British literary aesthetics movement. She was in some ways kind of slipped under the table, shall we say. Nobody really paid much attention to her after that. The only research that I found on her between 1935 and now is Peter Gunn's biography of her, which was in 1964. There's more biographies on her that have been written recently. Vinetta Colby's biography is an excellent one, if any of you are interested in reading it. It's very thorough, and she does an excellent job of really researching and getting into the depth of what she was most known for at the time. Quickly, so what I did my research on was, as I said before, the psychological catalyst. In each of her stories, there's usually a psychological catalyst in the form of an obsession that they find inherent in art or in the landscape or in a sculpture or in music. In a story that you'll find kind of at the bottom, Amour Duré, it's a story of a young man. He's a scholar. He's a history scholar. And he goes to Urbania. It's a made-up town in Italy. And there is researching a woman by the name of Medea di Carpi. Actually, he's researching the history of this place and comes across the history of this woman, Medea di Carpi. And he begins to research her. And as he researches her, he begins to fall slightly in love with this woman who was, in terms of today, a femme fatale. She was essentially I want to say a gold digger. She wanted power. She was. She had her son promoted in each instance to a higher level until finally she became the ruler of Urbania. She managed to kill off, I think, about four or five of her lovers, but all at the end would still hold fast to Medea, even though she would essentially abandon them and they would be killed because she would often have them go do her dirty work for her. They would go be her assassins and things like that. Well, so Spridian Trepka, who's the name of the scholar, stumbles across this history of her, and he becomes more engrossed with her history. He finds a small little portrait of her in one of the old museums, and starts to talk about how beautiful she is and how maybe she was kind of misunderstood as a woman, that she was just brilliant, and she was just beautiful, and she was a powerful, dominating woman, and what was so wrong with that? She was amazing, and she was misunderstood, and she was perhaps the true ruler of Urbania. Well, finally, the Archduke of Urbania catches hold of exactly what Medea is doing and has her murdered by a nun. That way she won't be susceptible to, you know, to influence any man he would send against her. And then, in order so that Medea's soul cannot harm him in the afterlife, he goes to, let's say, like a voodoo doctor that they have done in Italy and has them cast his spirit into a little tiny cast iron statue and places it inside of a statue in Urbania. Well, throughout all this, one day, Trepka is standing in this main castle there, and he looks at a mirror, and he sees the face of Medea behind him. And he turns around, and it's not her, it's a painting. But this is where art becomes a psychological catalyst, because this is when we see Spridian Trepka's kind of degeneration into obsession. Behind my own image stood another, a figure close to my shoulder, a face close to mine, and that figure, that face, hers, Medea de Carpi's. And such a portrait, for it is Medea, the real Medea, a thousand times more real, individual, and powerful than in other portraits. This is a strong example of the power of art to be psychologically influential. We wrote a treatise on the effects of art on humans entitled Beauty and Ugliness and Other Studies in Psychological Aesthetics. This was one of her interests and areas of research. In fact, she's often credited with being the first person to utilize the idea of empathy in relation to art. So in this passage with Medea, he believes for just one second that she's really there. And this triggers his obsession with her. Now, throughout the story, he begins to see manifestations of her. She writes him a note. One day he goes into an old church, and there's all these ghosts, and there Medea reaches out to him, and he chases her down the hall, you know, throughout the church, and then outside, and she's disappeared. And throughout the story, he gets engrossed more and more and more engrossed into this idea of Medea and that she's speaking to him. And one day he finds a note from her, and it says, "Oh, my love, Spridian, and you and I will be together. Just go to the statue of the Archduke, open it up, crush the little sepulcher that's inside, release the spirit, and you and I will be together forever." So he walks down to the statue, and he's got an axe in his hand, and he's going to destroy this statue. And on the way, he sees three of her lovers, all of which warn him, "Do not do this. She's evil. She's a temptress. You're never going to be with her." And he doesn't listen. He continues to head towards the statue. So he saws it open. He throws the little sepulcher down on the ground. Well, that morning, it ends with a note from his landlord saying that he was found dead, stabbed by an unknown hand in his room. Was it suicide or was it murder? They don't know. There's a lot of really interesting implications of this if you're going to turn to analyze this in terms of feminist studies by saying, obviously, it's interesting that the woman would become his obsession and then also his mode of destruction. This idea of a very powerful, very strong woman who was potentially misunderstood is now the destructor. She's what kills him as well as three or four other men. I talked mostly about the influence of the genius loci, the place of the church, and this idea of Italy, which Spridian took was very, very much invested in, and then also this idea of art becoming this psychological catalyst. On the whole, it was a really rewarding experience. I was first drawn to Vernon Lee mostly through a professor of mine who recommended her. And it turned out to be an amazing experience, one that not only extended my own research skills, but gave me a strong base in aesthetics as well as supernatural and literary theory, a lot of Gothic analysis. And it's interesting, as always, to be able to study somebody so intelligent and unique and opinionated and strong as Vernon Lee was. Her original name was Violet Paget. I don't know if I mentioned that earlier. But she changed it later on. I think she used it as a pen name when she was about 14 when she first began to publish. And the name stuck. Forever she was known as Vernon Lee. In fact, even among her friends, she was known to be slightly mannish looking. Here's a picture of her. And she wore, you know, slightly frumpy mannish clothes and was always known as Vernon Lee. That's all everybody ever called her. And she was never known as Violet Paget again, pretty much from that point on. Anyway, I'm excited that I got to share the research with you today. Are there any questions specifically about Vernon Lee or my studies or my research? Yes.
What do you plan to do in the future
with
the research you've done?
Well, I did use this as an honors thesis, and it's found and it's in the library. For my master's thesis, I'm moving more towards 20th century British and American because I feel like I spent 3 years on this. I should explore other facets of literature, but I'm hoping to keep this as a minor and continue to publish on her because she's just now becoming to be discovered. In fact, she's a great person to study right now if you're looking for someone to research because you can really be at the forefront of thought. Since there's so little written on her. I mean, it's not like writing on Shakespeare or Jane Austen. What can you say about Jane Austen that hasn't already been said? You know, you'd be really creative. But with her, there's a lot of room for really original research to be published. In fact, I'm going to a conference in January in Hawaii to get to present the rest of this research as well. So it opens up a lot of opportunities because it is so unique and original. You had a question, too?
Yeah, I was just going to ask why you studied specifically at Cambridge.
Well, because it's one of the best universities in the world, and I'd always wanted to go to England. So it's an amazing program. I would suggest you all go if you have the opportunity. You get the option of working specifically with a supervisor if you'd like. You can take classes, and then you get to live on campus in like an 18th century dorm. It was amazing. And get to work through their libraries, which are brilliant. And then you get to also work with a supervisor who's a specialist in your area and who you develop papers with. I mean, I came back from Cambridge having 20 pages of my thesis already written. And it was actually kind of amazing because Vernon Lee is so unknown. They actually had to go through the House of Lords in order to find me a supervisor. And I actually got to work with the foremost kind of person in England on Vernon Lee. His name is Shafqat Tohid, and he's brilliant. And I had to work in the British Library, so man, I got to travel every Thursday up to the British Library in London and actually work in one of the foremost research libraries in the world. So it was an amazing experience, to say the most. Yes?
Well, you kind of talked about how she comes after the main thrust of the Gothic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, what does she add to it? You know, she seems part of it. What does she add? What makes her...
If you follow a lot of Gothic conventions, in some ways, it is very formulaic with women's studies. I mean, it's obviously, there's a strong trend of women to write about this. But Vernon Lee brought in something much more in making it much more, I think, of a psychological Gothic, of a psychological supernatural, as well as bringing in the ties to art, past literature, and this idea of genius loci. So she was innovative in that way. And in fact, if you read her stories, you can see a lot of Gothic conventions in it, but I think they're much more subtle because her character development is so much stronger, and she does use a lot of, as I said, psychological. She was a friend of Henry James's, so the two of them used to collaborate a lot on their work. So that's why I think she's so different. And any other questions? Yes.
Curious, how did you find Vernon Lee? You said an instructor recommended.
Professor Wood. And I know we had the same Gothic literature class. Women. As a sophomore, one of my professors suggested doing an ORCA grant. And I'd taken a call from Professor Wood, and I absolutely loved her. I thought she was a great professor. And went up, asked if she had any research I could tag along with, if she had any recommendations. And she said, well, try Vernon Lee. I'm working on her right now. She's a great person to work with. There's a lot of room for original research. I went home and I read her and I thought she was interesting. And actually, it's cool for me to go back and look at the notebooks I had back that, 3 or 4 years ago when I first started working on her and look at my ideas on her and how much they developed and they changed as I read, much more of her work. She's published over 50 works at least. And there's more. In fact, just the other day I was down in the library and I discovered an article that I didn't even know existed. And I don't think, actually, Professor Wood didn't even know we had either. None of us had ever heard of it before. So there's a lot of ways that you can be really original and really be pushing the edge of scholarship with this. So, anything else? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rachel. I'll now introduce Sarah Williamson. Sarah Williamson is actually representing Jessica Cronner, who was our research recipient. And just before her her introduction, I'll tell a little about Jessica, who did the majority of this research. Jessica Cronner received her psychology degree and will receive her master's in marriage and family therapy from BYU in this December. In her clinical work and research, she focused on helping wives of pornography users. In 2006 to 2007, she worked at the Provo Counseling Center doing co-therapy for several groups of wives, and she conducted original research for her thesis project with collaborations in several clinics in the Mountain West region. She completed her thesis project and 500 hours of clinical work in July and now lives in California with her husband and baby girl, Emily. And Sarah has graciously been willing to present this for research in Jessica's behalf. And if you do have further questions that Sarah is unable to answer for you, she can get you connected with Jessica, or I can too. But Sarah Williamson grew up in the small town of Magna, Utah, which is on the west side of Salt Lake Valley.
She received an associate's degree from Ricks College by the time she was 19, and then moved to Phoenix, Arizona, where she graduated summa cum laude in Family and Human Development at Arizona State University. She was the first in her family to earn a bachelor's degree. After graduation, Williamson worked for several years for a child abuse prevention program in Phoenix before relocating to Provo to begin her master's degree in marriage and family therapy. She's now in her second year with plans to possibly complete a PhD. And also, she is the recipient of the home scholarship offered through her program. So we'll now turn the time over to Sarah.
Okay, first I have to apologize because Jessica asked me to do this a while ago but didn't actually get me the information that I needed to do it until Saturday. So it's been a little bit of a crazy week anyway, and so this isn't as polished as I'd like it. I didn't have time to dump it into a PowerPoint so we could be like multimedia. But I'm going to try and go through this in a way that hopefully isn't too boring just listening to me talk. Like Carrie said, Jessica did her research on helping wives of pornography users. So kind of the title that she uses for this particular presentation is The Effects of Disclosure versus Discovery on Wives of Pornography Users. So kind of background information for you. In the last 5 years, more than half of the U.S. population has access to the internet, and 20 to 33% of users of the internet use it for sexual purposes. So WordTracker reported that 10 of the top 20 searches online have to do with sexuality. So sex on the internet is absolutely huge. So a lot of men and women use pornography on the internet and don't consider it a problem, but it looks like about a third of users reported that it is problematic for them in their relationship. So the primary users of pornography who say, yeah, this is a problem, are married heterosexual males. And so this puts their wives in kind of a unique situation where they're not doing this, but it's causing a problem in their relationship, and usually it's a very hidden thing and there's a lot of secrets surrounding it. So their husband admitting to using pornography has been described as an incomprehensible new world that alters perception of three different areas. So it alters the perception of her relationship with her husband, it alters her perception of her own view and desirability, and her view of the character of her husband. So Jessica just finished up her stuff in marriage family therapy. That's what I'm doing. So her research was focused on, as a clinician, what do I need to do? What's important? What kind of navigating that whole thing? And the conclusion that she came to looking at this kind of research was that it's critical as clinicians to help women in these circumstances heal and to help their marriages heal as well, because this is a very hurtful and tender subject for most women who this is an issue for in their marriage. And so it leaves a lot of casualties behind, especially if people aren't able to help them. So many of the aspects of a woman's experience in this particular area is really unexplored by the literature. One of the topics that has been explored to a point in other areas, so in areas like infidelity, is if someone finds out about it, does it matter if they were told or if they discovered it? So that's kind of what Jessica was looking at, because there isn't any research as far as pornography goes on does it change the distress level of the marriage? Does it change the distress level of the spouse if they either just found it or if their spouse told them? So really quick definition of terms. In the research, the phrase online sexual behavior was used to include any form of online medium ranging from pictures, videos, sexually explicit chat rooms, audio files, live video streams, and text. Pornography is a commonly used term to describe all of these behaviors. So when I say pornography, that's what I'm referring to as any of those different things. Disclosure is the user of pornography freely telling his spouse about all or some of his behaviors. And discovery is the unintended revealing of pornography to the partner. So that would include her walking in while he's looking at pornography on the computer, or her intercepting an email or coming across files on the computer, or even her kind of suspecting what's going on and confronting him about it. Because he didn't come to her and tell her, she went ahead and confronted, which means he's kind of saying it, yeah, I did it, but it's more against his will than stepping up and volunteering and saying this is what's going on. Okay, so when Jessica was looking into researching all of this, the first thing she did was a review of literature. Oftentimes,
infidelity focuses on live affairs. But if you look at the definition of infidelity as a shift in emotional and sexual focus to another source outside the marital partner, then pornography can definitely be described as infidelity because those sexual thoughts and energies are channeled towards whatever it is that's on the computer as opposed to the spouse. And studies show that most women actually view pornography as a form of infidelity within their relationship. So this is an important connection, the infidelity and pornography thing, because the infidelity research kind of set the foundation for the research that Jessica was doing. So when looking specifically at women in relationships where their spouse is a pornography user, there are two different kinds of distress that the woman may experience. The first is personal distress. So the emotions surrounding discovery are often described as shock, betrayal, anger, pain, hopelessness, confusion, and shame. 42% of women report that their partner's use has made them feel insecure. One-third of participants felt like a sexual object more than a person, and 41% felt less attractive and desirable after discovering their partner's pornography use. So that's personal distress. Relational distress looks more like this. First, loss of trust. So after this discovery has been made, most women feel some sort of a fear of the future or ambivalence about how it's going to go and are worried about their ability to forgive their spouse. Loss of trust has effects on the partners of these users, such as they may start withholding sexual relations or they may become hypervigilant. So all of a sudden they become the porn police when they find out that this has been going on with their husband. Another relational issue as far as distress goes is they view the relationship negatively now. So women change their perceptions of their spouse and see them as sexually degraded, as lying, as unloving or selfish. And that women also begin to question the user's adequacy as a husband and father. The third aspect of relational distress is hopelessness. So at first, many women will feel hopeless about competing with the pornography because it's not real. They can't look like that. No real person looks like that. Airbrushes, man, you know? So they feel a real sense of hopelessness of comparing to something that's not real and it doesn't really exist. And then they also feel hopeless about the future of the relationship. Nearly a quarter of women who find themselves in this situation do dissolve the marriage because it just is too much to kind of get through. Okay, so then kind of shifting to the literature that's out there on the disclosure of infidelity. Within the infidelity research, planned disclosure, this came from a quote from an article that Jessica found, planned disclosure is the cornerstone of healing. So first, disclosure brings forgiveness. There was a study done of infidelity among college age students, and they found that disclosure was correlated with partner forgiveness. Disclosure also usually signaled to the spouse that the user was remorseful, and that was also very important in the forgiving, in being able to forgive. And disclosure sends a signal to the partner that it can be safe because they're willing to tell me this and be open about it. So the sense of lying, the sense of deceit around it is less when the spouse can come out and say, this is what happened, and when they express sorrow, that's kind of a signal, okay, if I forgive them, it's going to be okay because they're sorry, which means that they won't give that or do that again. So wives also may associate disclosure with motivation of the spouse to maintain the relationship, and that open and honest communication is really important. So disclosure helps facilitate forgiveness. Disclosure also increases trust. One study found that when a user did not give a complete and open disclosure, partners felt much more difficulty trying to restore the trust. And although disclosure may be distressing, wives appreciated the open and honest piece of that much more than if they just came across it. Okay, so here's what you've got. You've got pornography is seen as a form of infidelity, And with infidelity, disclosure is pretty important. So what Jessica's study is doing is trying to put the two together. So her purpose was to determine if disclosure of online sexual behavior by the user to his wife led to decreased personal and relational distress. So if he comes right out and tells her, do they have less distress for the relationship and less distress for her, as opposed to if she just found it on the computer? Okay, so that's kind of what she's looking at. So the hypothesis that she came up with, well, there's three of them. Okay, the first one is that if you have a discovery group, so they just found out about the pornography, and you have a disclosure group, so their spouse told them about the pornography, is the discovery group, do they have a significantly higher amount of relational distress? Do they have, the second hypothesis is they have a significant amount of personal distress. And then the third hypothesis is that those two kinds of distress are correlated. So if she has high personal distress, then the relational stress is also going to be high. So that's kind of what Jessica was looking at. So pretty much what she did was got in touch with people in the area who they specifically work with couples who face this issue. And they were able to connect her with people around Utah and also a few in Colorado. So when it's Mountain West, that's kind of what she's talking about, is a lot in Utah Valley, a few in Salt Lake, one in St. George, one in Colorado, or I think that was kind of the conglomeration of it. So what she did is said, okay, this is what I want to look at. If you have a couple in this situation, can you give them my information, at least to the female clients? And so if they agreed, then the female clients who were interested would get a packet that had different things that would measure the relational distress and measure their personal distress, and then they'd put it in the envelope and send it back to Jessica. So everything came directly to her. The participants ended up being 32 women. Interesting demographics is the average age was 34. There was a range of 21 to 59. Participants had been married for an average of 10 years, but the range was a year to 22 years. The average number of years since the wives first found out about the online sexual behavior was 6.4 years. And then Jessica couldn't, the scope of her research didn't extend this far, but she did note that there's a difference between, well, there's probably a difference between women who, okay, either it was disclosed here or discovered here, and now they've stopped. So what happens if it happens again and she discovers it or he tells her again? Like, what's that difference like? So she did note that about half of the participants, their husbands, the first time said, this is what has happened. But in subsequent times, over 60% just found out about it. So there was kind of that difference, but she didn't have the resources at that point to do a whole new study on that. So that was just kind of a side note. But so those were the participants. So she kind of broke it down, did all the big statistical analysis and everything. The results. The first hypothesis was found to be true. It was found to be significant that discovery of pornography use was associated with greater levels of relational distress. The other two hypotheses, she didn't find any kind of significant results there. But the results do have specific implications for women. So first, disclosure is an important first step towards being able to heal for the women individually and for the marriage as a whole. The study clarified that disclosure is correlated with lower relational distress when compared to discovery. And for me and Jessica as therapists, this is really important because the therapist should be aware of how discovery was made. How did this happen? If it's discovery, then there's going to be an increased sense of distress in the relationship, and that needs to be explored, which way this happened. And then if a therapist is working with a client who has an online sexual addiction, then it's good to encourage them to say, look, you need to tell your spouse, because if she just finds out, it's going to be worse. So it kind of goes from both directions as far as impacting women, is to support them and also to encourage their spouse to do what's going to be easiest on the relationship. Previous literature has shown that wives experience personal distress, including anxiety, depression, self-worth issues, after online sexual behavior is revealed, but there isn't a distinction about severity as far as personal distress. If it's, my anxiety is here, if he told me, but it's here if I found out. So that wasn't really clear from the study that Jessica did, and it also wasn't able to make that connection between personal distress and relational distress going up at the same time. But Jessica does mention a lot of that could be because of the limitations of her study, which was first that it was a pretty homogeneous sample. All the women reported being in therapy for concerns related to pornography behavior of their spouses. And all the women also were highly religious. So you might be able to generalize this to that same demographic, but to some women who aren't in that demographic, it may not translate across. So that was kind of a limitation. Another limitation was that it was a fairly small sample size. 32 is enough to kind of look and find out what was going on, but it needs to be more to be totally generalizable. And then there are a lot of other variables that tie into relationship distress. So how attached are they? Do they trust each other a lot? What's the timing of treatment? How long has it been since the discovery was made that can impact kind of the relationship that she found with this? So her suggestions for things like future research is to do qualitative studies to get a real clear understanding of what a woman's experience is like when this happens in her relationship. And then, kind of like I was talking about earlier, look at what repeated disclosure or discovery does to the relationship and how that changes it. So kind of her conclusion is that this present study substantiates a lot of the findings from previous research about the positive effects of disclosure and evidence that if something is disclosed, it leads to a lower level of marital distress. So kind of what I took from it as a clinician was, A, it's important to explore how the discovery was made, and B, it's, when appropriate, encourage disclosure to a spouse instead of running the risk that the spouse will just find out because it's going to be much more distressing for the relationship. Jessica's research. Any questions? Yes.
Is there any research that you know of at all, like maybe not even at BYU but anywhere, of like wives who have pornography problems and the distress of husbands?
I don't know of anything because the overarching theme is it tends to be men,
yeah.
And it tends to focus more on like the internet stuff or the picture stuff. So I haven't ever seen anything that even looks at. I mean, I know that there's stuff out there that says women are more drawn to like verbal pornography, but I haven't seen anything that looks at husband's distress in relation to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wondered if there was a distinction in this study of whether the women were the ones that had initiated going to therapy or the men, and if that made a difference in how that whole thing was approached. If the men
yeah.
were the ones that mm-hmm. initiated, were they more likely to disclose as opposed to having their wives discover or
right. I don't think that she differentiated between that because she already had enough variables with just the two, because if you add in one more thing, you have to run all of your numbers again, and that makes for a longer and longer thesis. So I don't think she differentiated. Sorry, you. I was like, it was in the corner. No.
I was just wondering if you've ever dealt with, like, or talked to someone who's had problems with pornography and what you learned from that.
Me personally? I have. It depends a lot on the person. Pornography tends to be an escape mechanism. So often what will happen is you'll get young men who were exposed early in their life, so either as children or teenagers, and they found that there really is a chemical reaction in their brain that makes them feel better when they view it. Okay, so it becomes a coping mechanism, just like drugs, just like alcohol, just like eating, just like shopping, just, you know, some of those things where there's this anticipation of this event that's going to relieve my stress, and so they go ahead and engage in it, and then after that they feel better. That better is usually short-lived because eventually they get caught in a cycle that just keeps going and then they can't stop. So a lot of the reasons for it are they use it as a coping mechanism and never found anything else to substitute as a better coping mechanism, so it just goes on and on. Does that make sense? It depends on where they're at in the cycle, because sometimes you can get someone who just kind of dabbled as a teenager, and then 10 years later as an adult, things get really, really stressful, and they fall back into it. So sometimes they'll have other coping mechanisms that are already in place. They just need to go back and look at those, figure out what are the things that trigger it. Is it that there's a lot of stress at work? Is it because I had a fight with my wife and now I don't feel good about myself? Is it, you know, all of these different things that can cause stress, to look and say, okay, what are my triggers? How can I avoid those triggers? How can I put safeguards around me so that it's not available to me? Like all those kind of things. And therapy is really helpful in kind of helping people to walk through those steps and see what it is that they need to do to kind of identify and change. And yeah. Did you?
Sorry, I just have one last
question. No, you're okay.
I was just wondering what, like, if there's any studies done on guys that are homosexual, and if pornography plays a huge part in that, or if, because you said, you mentioned that most, I think you said 20, or yeah, most of the guy, or most of the people who are addicted to pornography are heterosexual married men.
Well, it's most who find it troubling in their relationship. So in homosexual relationships, my guess would be that they're typically, if they're in a relationship, they're typically going to be more liberal anyway, right? Because they've come out, they've found a way to establish a network, and they're with somebody now. So pornography probably isn't wrong to them, so it's probably not troubling in the relationship. That is just my logical guess, so don't quote me. But that would be my guess. Okay. Someone, yes.
Yeah, I was wondering about, like, men who use pornography and, like, told their wives about it and then they stopped. How high is the percentage of men that fall back into it later?
I do not know exact statistics on that, but personal experience and seeing, because I have enough clients and enough friends and people and family, you know, that it seems to be fairly high, especially if the original exposure was when they were very young and they used it for a long time. But I don't know exact numbers, sorry. Okay, there is a hand over here.
Oh, I was just wondering if there were any correlating indicators of what might, I know each case is different, but just people who lapse back into pornography,
mm-hmm.
Like, were there any common
threads
shared between the two men?
You want to know what? I'm not sure. This is a very interesting topic, and I've done minimal amount of research on it, but I haven't done enough to put together a good presentation on some of the other things connected. So I don't know. I'm sorry.
I just thought it was weird. Like, if you come out and tell your wife about it, mm-hmm. you guys are coming clean, and then fall back on it.
Yeah.
It's, you know,
mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times that can happen over a period of years. So it's after the relationship is feeling safer, and so there's not that fear anymore that she'll leave me if she finds out that I've done this again, because now they feel safe again. So it may not be quite as much a motivating factor after some time has passed, and so it's easier to fall back in. Yeah. Yeah.
I was just curious, is there a correlation in terms of the results, like marriage dissolution and whatnot, between live affairs and the pornography in this study?
Jessica didn't go quite that far with her stuff, because she only looked at the online sexual behavior. She didn't look specifically at infidelity. That was just kind of the basis. The thing is that women tend to be more upset about emotional affairs, and men seem to be more upset about physical affairs. So for women, if she feels like he's been directing all of his emotions towards this other thing, whether it's pornography or whether it's a person, a live affair, my guess is that it would be close to the same. But I don't know that for sure. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
So in treatment of pornography, do you approach it as you would any other addictive behavior, like gambling, cigarettes?
You can. Well, Dr. Mark Butler over at the Comprehensive Clinic in the MFT program, he has an amazing approach that I really, really like, where his focus is on the relationship and how that can be used as an agent for healing and for recovery for the user. So kind of what his model is if I can focus on the wife and make sure that she's heard and that he knows her pain, and that he can empathize with her pain, then that is motivation for him to be clean. And so which is great because so many wives get really ignored through this process because it's all about him and it's all about his addiction. And so the focus kind of shifts, and in shifting the husband's focus to the wife, then, because a lot of people say, well, okay, don't do it anymore, don't do it anymore, don't think about it, don't do it anymore, but that still puts the energy into the problem, whereas if you can shift the energy to the wife, then his focus is somewhere else, and they both end up getting what they need, because he's getting support from her, and she's getting heard, and her pain is being explored, and she's been able to heal as well. So I really buy into that model. I think that it's a great model to work off of with this particular thing, which you could use with other kinds of addiction, but I don't think people do as much. Yeah, and then there was, maybe not. Okay, any other questions? Okay.
Oh, thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
Thank you again for all coming. We appreciate the work that these students have done and wish them well in their future with the continued studies. And thanks for coming. Again, next week's the Women's Studies Film Series, and 2 weeks from now, Colloquia will be in here, and Professor Valerie Hudson will be presenting. So.